Nearly a million Tutsi people were slaughtered by members of the Hutu majority government during the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Ambassador Pierre Richard Prosper says during times of mass atrocities and genocide, the international community must take action.
Even if it's symbolic, you need to do something. We can't just, again, going back to Syria and Iraq, can't just sit there and say, oh, this is terrible, and do nothing. You know, Boko Haram, oh, it's terrible. These girls have been in custody for years. And we just say, oh, this is terrible, and we condemn it, and nothing happens. So it really comes down to political will. If there's a will, you know, we can make a difference.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, we're putting the election results aside, and instead the discussion this hour, a call for action on genocide occurring today in parts of the world by a prosecutor who tried war criminals in Rwanda. That's coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Well, America is now reviewing the results of the election, but on this program today, we are steering the conversation away to an issue that has been all but ignored by most American media. That is the issue of genocide and the international community's lack of action on it. Take, for instance, the millions of Yazidi people who inhabit northern Iraq and Syria who have been fleeing mass persecution and genocide by the Islamic State for several years now. Earlier this year, Secretary of State John Kerry said the actions of ISIS in the region constitute genocide. Or Boko Haram, the Nigerian terrorist group associated with ISIS that has killed 20,000 people and displaced 2.3 million people from their homes since 2009. Ambassador Pierre Richard Prosper says for both of these instances, the international community, including the U.S. government, needs to act to stop the killing and atrocities. Ambassador Prosper served as the second United States ambassador at large for war crimes issues under President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2005. In the late 1990s, he prosecuted the atrocities of Rwandan war criminals as part of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He is known for leading the prosecution of the case Prosecutor versus John Paul Akayesu, the first ever case of genocide under the 1948 Convention on Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. In the 14-month trial, he won additional life sentence convictions for crimes against humanity and was able to convince the tribunal to recognize rape as an act of genocide and a crime against humanity during conflict, something that until then had not been accomplished. The trial of John Paul Akayesu and the work of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda is examined in the 2016 documentary film The Uncondemned. It will be screening November 18th through the 24th at Salt Lake City's Broadway Center Theater. Ambassador Pierre Richard Prosper's talk was recorded earlier this week on November 7th, 2016.
It's a pleasure to be here today and having been invited to be part of this forum at the Hinckley Institute. It's also a special place for me because my father-in-law, R.J. Snow, was a director here at one point for about 10 years. His family is here in the audience today. So coming here and sharing thoughts with you has extra meaning. Today we're going to talk about Rwanda. And you're probably thinking, okay, well, while this is an interesting topic, why is it relevant today? We're talking about a genocide that occurred roughly 22 years ago. But I think what happened in Rwanda and the lessons learned from Rwanda continue to apply today, and it is a reminder to all of us about our own personal responsibilities. When you just look around what's happening, whether it's in Syria, Iraq, with the Yazidi population, you think about what's happening in Nigeria with Boko Haram, you realize that the international community needs to act and needs to make a difference. And really the topic for today is that difference starts with us as individuals. But to understand really why there is a significance here, we do need to go back in time, 22 years, and talk about what happened. And when I think about Rwanda, I think the best way to convey the story is to convey it through the eyes of someone who is my hero, Witness JJ. Witness JJ, and I'll explain later why we call her Witness JJ, is a Rwandese woman. She lived all of her life in Rwanda. Rwanda, a country that is the size of the state of Maryland, and back in 1994 had a population of about 8 million people. It was ethnically divided in numbers, 85% Hutu, 14% Tutsi, and 1% of this other group called Twa. They lived peacefully for a very long time, but with colonialization, a division was built. You see, the Belgians back in the early part of around in 1900s decided to rule through the Tutsi population because they felt that the Tutsi population looked more European. In fact, when you go back and you look at footage, you could see the Belgians measuring the nose of people, measuring their height to see if they looked European. If so, they would call them the Tutsis and put them in charge. In 1959, at the end of colonialization, the power structure inverted in Rwanda, and the Hutus took over. Not pleased with having been ruled by the Tutsis, they begin to suppress, oppress, and kill the population, to the point where people will call that a genocide that occurred back then. But the reality as well was that you had 200,000 refugees flee to Uganda and form a base of population there. Over the years, the Hutu regime ruled with oppression against the Tutsi population, to the point where in 1990, the Tutsis from Uganda decided that they needed to come back. They wanted to repatriate and share in the power and share in the country. And it began a war in 1990. This war went back and forth for several years with intense propaganda. The propaganda that you saw in World War II in Nazi Germany dehumanizing the opponents, where the Hutus would make the Tutsis, the 14% of the population, seem less human. In 1993, the United Nations came in and brokered this peace agreement called the Arusha Peace Accords. The Arusha Peace Accords called for power sharing between the two parties. The United Nations sent in peacekeepers, 5,000 peacekeepers, to help bring in this peace. But the peace was fragile. By the time 1994 rolled around, everyone saw that there was a problem coming. There was a problem where that the Hutus were not committed to implementing this peace agreement. Weapons started to come into the country. Reports started to come in that Hutu militia were mobilizing to kill Tutsis in the community. There were insurgents, some massacres that would take place. Then on April 6th of 1994, after a meeting in Arusha, Tanzania, where the United Nations was really pressing for the implementation of the peace accord, the then president of Rwanda, a Hutu, was flying back to Rwanda with the Burundian president. As the plane was about to land in Rwanda, it was shot down. To this date, it's a mystery as to who shot it down. But once the plane was shot down, killing the president and all those on board, immediately Hutu militias took to the streets, set up roadblocks. They went and killed the prime minister, a female, a moderate Hutu, who people believe would actually support the power-sharing agreement. They killed all other moderate Hutus who would begin to stand in the way of the extremist agenda, which is to take full control of the country and eliminating the Tutsi population. They set up roadblocks. And when you're at a roadblock, there's video footage of this, they would stop people. They'll say, let me check your ethnic card. If you're a Hutu, you're allowed to pass. If you're a Tutsi, off to the side. And when they put you off to the side, the men and the boys were massacred, killed with machetes and sticks. The international community knew what was happening. Our government knew what was happening. We had 5,000 US peacekeepers there watching what was happening. But the Security Council, in its wisdom, decided, well, we don't want to lose any peacekeepers' lives, so we are pulling out. They pulled all but 500 peacekeepers of the 5,000 out of the country. The result was that within a 100-day period, 1 million people were killed. I mean, think about that. 1 million people in 100 days, that's about 10,000 people a day, an alarming rate. And the international community watched as this took place. Witness JJ was living in a small town of Taba. She tells a story when you hear from her that she heard on the radio of the plane crashing. She heard of the roadblocks and the interim leaders being killed, Tutsi leadership being killed. She ran outside and saw her father, brother, being killed. And it was at a point where her mother looked at her and her sister and said, run, just get out of here, go and hide. She and her sister separate. And then she tells of her journey to the city hall where she thought she would receive sanctuary, where she is attacked repeatedly for weeks and violated sexually in the most horrific, horrific manners. We need not even get into the details here, but if you use your imagination, the reality will exceed that imagination of what happened to her. So when she gets to the Bureau Communal, which is the city hall, she is with other women held as sex slaves, watching the militia killing people and watching her local leader, Jean-Paul Akayesu, who she thought would give her sanctuary, turn against her and mobilize these forces. Now, at the time in 1994, when this was happening, I was a lawyer in Los Angeles. In fact, I was a DA. I had no idea that this was happening. No idea that within a 100-day period, 1 million people were being killed. In fact, for those that can remember this, in 1994 at this time, we were all concerned with O.J. Simpson and that trial. We never even thought about what was happening in Rwanda, what was our responsibility. It was an effective blackout. And it wasn't until I was approached by someone that the reality came to bear, and I was ultimately educated. The international community, recognizing that it needed to respond, set up an international tribunal, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And in fact, there was another failure simultaneously, and that was in Bosnia, where Srebrenica saw the massacres of 7,000 men, Muslim men. So a tribunal was set up there. The decision was that, well, if we couldn't stop these crimes against humanity and these war crimes, well, the international community should hold these perpetrators accountable. These were the first tribunals, international tribunals ever. Because if you go back to World War II, where we had war crimes tribunals, they were the victors, the four Allied powers that came together to prosecute the Germans and the Japanese. So the first time the United Nations was building an apparatus, putting it together to bring justice. I was approached and asked to be part of this tribunal. When I first got to the tribunal, I had these ideas. I was a deputy district attorney. I was then a federal prosecutor. I had these ideas of, wow, now we're going to the next level. You know, we're going to have all the resources that we need to really bring justice and promote accountability. But when I got there, I learned that the United Nations was not prepared for this. There were no resources, no administrative apparatus. We had to build everything from scratch. We had to sit there and decide, well, what are the rules? You know, we think of our courtrooms today, and you have the law books, you just go next door, that's codified with every scenario envisioned. We, a group of us, just would sit there, a group of 15, and try to decide, all right, what rules do we need? We had a core basis of rules, about close to about 100 rules that covered the entire process, but we needed more. But this process became extremely complicated because my colleagues there were all from different jurisdictions. We had people from common law, as myself, and people from civil law. You had Chinese, French, Belgian, Bangladeshi, you name it. We had every jurisdiction almost represented. And we would have to debate over what would our approach be. We would debate over letterhead. But we ultimately came together and we brought the case against Jean-Paul Akayesu, which proved to be the first case of genocide in the history of the world. Genocide Convention was passed in 1948, and it remained dormant until our group dusted it off and brought it to life. Genocide is something that continues today. It is a series of acts committed by perpetrators designed to destroy an ethnic group. When I went to Rwanda, we would look at it thinking, oh, you're going to kill a group, eliminate a group. But we quickly learned that it is more than killing, because you can destroy a group and yet its members may still be alive. And once we came into that realization and we just made that legal interpretation, a light bulb went off. And that light bulb was, we can include sexual violence as an act of genocide. Because if you think of Witness JJ, imagine you see the entire leadership being killed around you, not only the strength of the physical strength of the community, but the intellectual strength. You have the moderate Hutus who would protect you being killed. You have Tutsi leadership who could fill a vacuum being killed. You have your husband, brothers being killed. You're seeing your witnesses, people around you, being sexually violated. And then you are sexually violated repeatedly. How do you think you would feel after that? You may still be alive, but you will be destroyed. Now multiply that with everyone around you in your group feeling the same way. That ethnic group no longer contributes to humanity. While they may be alive, they're literally a walking dead. And that is what the Genocide Convention is designed to protect. It's designed to protect we as humanity. It's designed to protect our diversity. It's designed to protect our differences so that we can all benefit from our differences. So once you begin to destroy a group, whether or not it's physical in death or it's serious bodily or mental harm such as rape, when you destroy that group, we as humanity suffer. So our job was to make this case before this tribunal for the very first time. As you can imagine, it was a difficult process. It was difficult in collecting the evidence of genocide, standing in mass graves, holding human parts in your hand, listening to the testimony of these victims, survivors, and witnesses, asking the witnesses, survivors, to come forward and relive the horror for an international community that abandoned them a year earlier. This is where Witness JJ comes in. She was a witness in my trial. We gave her the pseudonym JJ to protect her identity. I remember approaching JJ, asking her to be a witness and to testify about what happened to her. Testify about the sexual violence. Remember, at that time, it had never, ever been done before. We were asking her to not overcome her personal emotional trauma, but also deal with the shame and the taboo associated with it. We were asking her to speak out and identify herself as someone that had been violated numerous times by numerous perpetrators, and put that letter on her back so the community knows that she was a victim and survivor, so that the world knows that she was a victim and survivor. Witness JJ decided to accept that challenge. A rural Rwandese illiterate farmer decided that it was important to step up, tell her story for the sake of humanity. Think about that. Because of Witness JJ's courage and those that followed her, we were able to convict Jean-Paul Akayesu of genocide, crimes against humanity, and both included acts of rape and sexual violence. So for the first time, we were able to put the crime of sexual violence on equal footing with all other crimes. World War II didn't happen. It was a spoil of war. All the other conflicts considered a spoil of war. But JJ showed the courage. And in fact, one of the best moments was when she actually testified. Terrified, she was on the stand with a very, very meek voice, beginning to talk about what happened to her. And I'll never forget that moment where she began to find her stride and her voice became stronger and stronger and stronger. And she began to point her finger at the accused, saying, "This is what you did to me. It is because of you that this happened." And you could see her shaking the shame, pointing the finger of accusation, putting the accused on the same plane as her, someone that she would before go to hat in hand with great deference, making him answer for his acts. And the beautiful thing about it is we were witnessing the rule of law in action, because that's what it's about, where a rural farmer, illiterate, can point to a party leader, a political leader, and hold them accountable for their actions. That is why she's a hero. Today, when you think about rape, sexual violence, and time of war, when the law school studies rape, sexual violence, and time of war as something that is punishable, they study the Akayesu case and they study the story of Witness JJ and her colleagues. So an individual can make a difference. A rural farmer can make a difference.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Ambassador Pierre Richard Prosper spoke earlier this week at the University of Utah. Prosper spoke about his experience prosecuting the atrocities of Rwandan war criminals in the late 1990s as part of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He says the international community today needs to act to stop current genocides occurring in northern Iraq and Syria against groups like the Yazidi people by ISIS or against Christians in Nigeria by Boko Haram. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them in their entirety as a public service. And today, we are airing a talk given earlier this week by Ambassador Pierre Richard Prosper. Ambassador Prosper served as the second United States Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues under President George W. Bush. He prosecuted the atrocities of Rwandan war criminals in the late 1990s as part of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Ambassador Prosper succeeded in convincing the tribunal to recognize rape as an act of genocide and a crime against humanity during conflict. The story behind the UN's International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda is documented in a new film that will be screening next week at Salt Lake's Broadway Theater.
Now, next week, on the 18th of November, we, at the Broadway Theater, the film The Uncondemned, write this down, will be playing from the 18th to the 24th. The 18th will be sponsored by the Hinckley Institute. It is a documentary, a critically acclaimed documentary, award-winning documentary about this case, and it tells the story of Witness JJ and the others. It tells the story about young people. Many of us were the age of the people in this group, in this room, who made a difference. Human rights activists, lawyers, and others who decided to fight against impunity to bring justice in this case. If you attend, or when you attend the film, you will see Witness JJ, and you will see her strength and her courage. You will see that she's been empowered by speaking out, by pushing the rule of law. In fact, 2 weeks ago, we premiered the film at the floor of the United Nations, on the floor of the United Nations, before 700 people. We had the Undersecretary General for Sexual Violence present. We had the Undersecretary General and Special Representative to the Secretary General for the Prevention of Genocide present. We had some Yazidi women who are horrifically being violated as we speak, present, telling their story. We also had Witness JJ and her colleagues present. What was amazing about that was watching Witness JJ now being able to sit with her shoulders square, recognizing that she has made a difference by speaking out. When we first saw her, she was meek. Today, she's a symbol of international justice, because she made the decision to speak. Now, as I said, this is relevant because of what's happening. When you hear of Boko Haram kidnapping girls, you hear of ISIS kidnapping girls and putting them through these horrific events, our conscience should be shocked. The lesson from Rwanda is that we need to speak out, that we need to act. I am afraid that today we are not doing that. We have lost our political will. While Secretary Kerry called it a genocide, that's not good enough when you're dealing with the Yazidi population. Giving it a name is not enough. We need action. You need to prevent these abuses from occurring. We need to hold perpetrators accountable. We cannot just shake our head and think, well, this is the new norm. It's too bad. It's awful. Let's move on and talk about something else. The action, however, begins with us. We all have to look to see what we can do. Now, I'm not saying that we go to Rwanda or go to Iraq or Syria, but we all have the power to voice our concerns, to speak out, to push our lawmakers, our elected officials, into action. We shouldn't dismiss it because it's Africa or because they're Arab or whatever it may be. We are all part of humanity. Now, I almost did not go to Rwanda. And I remember at that time, my friends actually thought I was crazy because that had never been done before. There were literally bodies in the streets. And I remember just going back and forth with friends and in my mind thinking, geez, I don't know if I want to do this, but it just kept sticking with me. And I realized that if I didn't do it, I would have a lifetime of regret. And if I did it, the worst case scenario is a year or so of your lifetime that's difficult. So I decided to leave my comfort zone. And it was a good comfort zone. I was living on the beach, you know, in LA. Life was good. But if you want to make a difference, you have to leave your comfort zone. Be prepared to make a sacrifice for humanity, whatever it may be. Because what is happening over there does have an impact on us. Whether you think it does or not, it has an impact. If we let those elements prevail, it will come closer and closer to us, and it's a statement about us. Now, what I like about forums such as today, and what I appreciate about the Hinckley Institute, is that it's a place where we can talk about this. It's a place where we can form our own thoughts as to what should we be doing. It's a place to come up with policy. Tomorrow is a big day. A new leader will be elected. He or she will need to be pushed by us for the sake of future generations. So when you think about Rwanda, international justice, then and now, then we did something. Now we need to do something. So I hope that this talk enlightens some of you. I highly recommend that you come see the film, because it's a film that will be around for a while and will stay with you and will trigger thoughts. So with that, I will stop here, open the floor to questions, and we can have a good conversation on these topics. Thank you.
So with the questions, if you could just wait for the microphone and then introduce yourself and something about you.
Hi, I'm Enzo. I've been in a class that actually has looked at Rwanda for about 3 years. Not in it anymore, but I just was curious, what do you think about, looking at crimes from groups like the RPF or maybe the French with Operation Turquoise in relation to this? Because does the UN have any, apparatus to even charge those groups? Because I know there's been some things in the country with genocide denier laws that I guess the new government has controlled the narrative of what has happened. But I guess, what do you think about prosecuting other groups? Because there is some idea that the RPF, so the Tutsi group from the north, did commit violations as well, of course, some of these high-ranking generals, they should be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. But I'm just kind of curious about, France, the RPF, and also maybe even the international community, because we look at what these people have done, but we look at what other groups have not done. That seems interesting too. So that's my question.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. And I think that the first answer is international justice, number one, is not perfect. And number two, it's not, in my view, the final, the ultimate, whatever it may be, solution. We need to have a broad-ranging look at justice and accountability. The first point I want to make is when we talk about accountability, we must separate it from punishment. Those are two different things. I think you need accountability. People need to be recognized for committing acts and their violations. But the punishment may be different. It may be no punishment. Look at South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There was accountability, but in order to get the amnesty, you had to admit that you perpetrated the crimes, and then you would get the amnesty, because that is what would work best for the society. So one is, we have to look at what works best for the society when developing these things, but we need accountability. Second, the international tribunals, it's impossible to prosecute every person. And where do you find the balance? If you look at today, we have a permanent international criminal court, which people are hailing as the latest and greatest step in justice. But that is flawed as well. You know, the International Criminal Court right now is, if it looks at Sudan, it's looking at some of these other places, it's indicting maybe five people. Five people for hundreds of thousands of people being killed, and whether it's Darfur, the Congo, Uganda, or elsewhere. So what we need to be doing is coming up with justice solutions that are multifaceted. So you have an international tribunal that can go after orchestrators and organizers. We have domestic processes that can go after certain individuals that are still high ranking. Or you have reconciliation processes that provide accountability but allow the people to advance. But when you deal with these crimes, they are hyper-political, and there will be people who are ultimately protected. We can talk about the French. You can talk about people who talk about the RPA or RPF or whatever it may be. You will see that the French, for example, will not discuss what happened behind Operation Turquoise. Operation Turquoise, essentially, for those that you don't know, is halfway through the genocide, the French sent in troops. And they set up the wall, a turquoise curtain, as they called it. And that curtain essentially allowed all the Hutu militia to flee to Zaire, and they stopped the advancing RPF troops that were bringing an end to the genocide. Behind that curtain is where the most of the genocide took place. Now, people say the French should be prosecuted. People say the Paul Kagame should be prosecuted. What this shows you is that international justice is not perfect, and we need to find mechanisms that work.
Just to let you know that, my name is Ali Usar. They call me Doc. I graduated from Caltech, California Institute of Technology, 20 years ago. I got my PhD in electrical engineering. My parents came to the U.S. when I was 9 years old. I was born in Senegal, West Africa. Just like you said earlier, need action. Tomorrow, big day, election. You know, like, back to action. Talking may be good, but action is better. And nothing is good where better is possible. Now, there was a genocide before in Nigeria, before Rwanda. This happened in 1967. It lasted 30 months, 2.5 years, 1967 to 1971. Almost 1.5 million people were slaughtered. Babies, rape, women, rape, poison. I said to myself, I was just a kid, I hope this will never happen again in Africa. And here comes Rwanda, 1994. You know, going back, my grandfather, he was the president of Senegal. He was the first president of Senegal. He died, you know. I told him there should be a term limit. That's what Africa needs. Most of them are crooks, cracks, opportunists. And there are 54 countries in Africa. And they are my presidents, but they're not my leaders because they don't have the leadership abilities to bring people together. That's why you have all these things happening. Now, back to Nigeria. This was Biafra. It's in southeast Nigeria. They have a population, as you know, the Igbos, the Hausas, I'll make it real quick. The Igbos, the Hausas. The Igbos said, hey, we are tired of Nigerian government. We want our independence. And they did, you know. They celebrated for about 2-3 months. Here comes Nigerian government. That's when they slaughtered all of it. There's a book written by their own Chinua Achebe, the title of the book is Things Fell Apart. I repeat, things fell apart. It's all about the war. My question to you, where do you see Africa 20, 30 years from now? Thank you.
Well, I think that's that's an important question, and I think this is where the idea of people beginning to speak out and voice their concerns is important, because you're right, we still have a generation of leaders in Africa that will stay there until death and view it as an opportunity to get rich. But fortunately, I think now the world is getting smaller, and with social media and so forth, you're starting to see civil society get stronger. But the only way it's going to get stronger is that if we plant and reinforce the rule of law in these societies. And that is why when we talk about international tribunals, they're great, but they're really for us. That's my view. They're in the end, they're for the international community. We feel good. They don't bring enough to the people. So we have to do more at the grassroots level and localize the process and also create ownership so that the people's voices mean something. And I think we're starting to see that a little bit in places of Africa, but it's gonna take a while. And we have to think about, Africa, if you think of it from a democratic development perspective, it's still very, very young. All these countries were colonies up until the 60s. Then after the 60s, through at least 1990, they were all under the thumb of the Cold War. And you're either with the East or the West, and dictators were accepted. So when you get to the 90s, that's when you're starting to see, in my view, the process of democracy begin to, fight its way. And sometimes that involves conflict. But I think with time, hopefully we'll see a progression that will allow it to grow. And Africa is a huge continent with 1 billion people and is a huge economic market. So the potential is huge. So I remain hopeful to answer your question, but there will be some stops and starts along the way.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just tuning in, last week the Hinckley Institute hosted Ambassador Pierre Richard Prosper. Ambassador Prosper prosecuted the atrocities of Rwandan war criminals in the late 1990s as part of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and he succeeded in convincing the tribunal to recognize rape as an act of genocide. Prosper says that similar to Rwanda nearly 20 years ago, atrocities and genocide are occurring again in northern Iraq and in Nigeria and other parts of the world, and that the international community, led by the U.S. government, needs to take action. Following his talk, Ambassador Pierre Richard Prosper took questions from the audience.
My name is Michaela Lehman. I am a biology major here at the University of Utah. And during your talk, I was wondering, what could the international community have done in Rwanda in order to prevent the genocide? Because in order to respect Rwanda's sovereignty, we can't just throw all of our peacekeepers in there.
Yep. Well, actually, there's a couple elements with that. There were peacekeepers there, and we just needed them to act. They had the mandate and the authority to act. Two, while there are sovereignty issues for all of us, if the Security Council acts under Chapter 7, which is an obligatory provision, it obligates all nations of the world to follow. So if you're a member of the United Nations, which is Rwanda, which is all these countries, which is the bulk, basically every country in the world, if the Security Council dictates something under Chapter 7, you're mandated to respond. Now, what the international community could have done is, in my view, if you fought back a little bit, it would have made a difference. And really, the genocide, if you look at the way it unfolded, you had, I can't remember what the figures were in the first week. By third week of April, or end of April, the numbers were at roughly 200,000 people killed. So that leaves the last 2 months of 800,000, 400,000 per month. And that's simply because they realized the international community was not coming. No one was in their way. You know, had we flown an F-15 over the country, done a couple of strategic strikes, people would have realized, okay, maybe something's happening. Now, it wouldn't have stopped all the killing, but I'm pretty sure 1 million people would not have died. So what we need in Rwanda or elsewhere is for action. And even if it's symbolic, you need to do something. We can't just, again, going back to Syria and Iraq, can't just sit there and say, oh, this is terrible, and do nothing. You know, Boko Haram, oh, it's terrible. These girls have been in custody for years. And we just say, oh, this is terrible, and we condemn it, and nothing happens. What we have special forces. The world has special forces. The French, you name it, who are very elite people. I'm sure we know exactly where they are. The Nigerians knew where they were. So it really comes down to political will. If there's a will, you know, we can make a difference.
I'm Tim Chambliss. I teach in the Department of Political Science. You've made reference to formal nation states, to Rwanda, Nigeria, South Sudan. But you've also made reference to the plight of the Yazidis. Mm-hmm. And the tragedy they're experiencing with non-state actors. Yeah. You've said that tomorrow we're going to choose a new leader for the country. And I'm wondering if Donald Trump were here, if Hillary Clinton were here listening to you, what would you say to them in terms of using the power of the United States being pushed, the military power as well as the diplomatic power, the economic power, to stop the tragedies? Because when we talk about 1 million people killed in 100 days, that's the population of Salt Lake County today, to put a human face on it. So that doing nothing doesn't solve the problem. And so specifically, what does the new commander-in-chief do of the most powerful country in the world?
Well, thank you, and I think that's a critical question. What I'm about to say is not a political statement. Okay, so let's put this in context, but it's important. We can't lead from behind. You know, people around the world look up to the United States. They look to us to show leadership, to show courage, to show action. I mean, we're that shiny house on the hill, as they say. They expect the United States to do something. Now, they may not always agree, but people look to say, well, what will the United States do? Is the United States going to lead on this matter? And I'm afraid what's been happening is not only the United States, but the international community, is there's a void. And everyone is just sitting back, we're talking about it, but we're not pushing the international community. When I was ambassador, one of the things that we used to do, and we use this term very deliberately, we used to drive consensus. You know, people say build consensus. Let's not build consensus, because build consensus is you end up with the lowest common denominator. If you believe in something, you drive consensus. You take everyone to that point. So the new leader needs to drive consensus on this. Now, I'm not saying that we need to act alone, and we shouldn't. But the new leader needs to get in there, get in New York, get into the capitals of these countries, get with these leaders and say, we have to do something. Let's build a special force, a task force, whatever it may be. Let's get in there. It's possible. It can be done. And I think particularly with these non-state actors, the more we don't act on ISIS, the stronger they become. I mean, think about years ago when we started first hearing about ISIS, and there were a few, you know, beheadings on TV. We're like, oh, that's terrible. You know, we have these terrorists beheading people. 4 years later, they're full-on military force waging attack in Europe and elsewhere, because of the international community's inaction. So I think we need to recognize that if you assume that seat of power, it's not for a title, it's for responsibility.
So I was going to ask, my name is Bailey, first of all, and I'm a student here at the U. So being a college student and from a grassroots level, what can people like us do, I suppose, in an issue such as this?
Yeah, I think, you know, having been in government, I think the voice of the people, of grassroots, is significant. Because you do have to, you know, one thing I will say in fairness to leaders is while we have this issue, let's talk about, you know, ISIS, Yazidi population, whatever it may be, it is one of many. And it's easy to get distracted because every day there's a new issue. So what we need is we need everyone to constantly continue to ring that bell, ring the alarm, push the leaders, push the international community, push civil society. You know, let's help people. There are things NGOs do a great job, and I think when you go see the film, you'll see the work that Human Rights Watch did. I mean, they were instrumental in getting rape and sexual violence recognized. So there are things that we can do without being in government, either as part of NGOs or as individuals. And the louder our voice is, the more likely you'll get action, either by pushing it or we give comfort to the policymakers to take a brave step forward.
My name's Zach, and I'm a student at the Hinckley Forums class. My question is, you mentioned the Security Council earlier, and in terms of Syria, the Big Five were pretty divided, mostly the U.S. and Russia. So how would they be effective in making a difference when one country can just veto and plan away, and how do you think we as kind of the political voice should be able to get them to act?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the problems with the Security Council today is everyone is afraid of a veto. And what I mean by that is they hear Russia may veto, China may veto, or someone may veto, therefore, let's not pursue it. My view is make them veto. Push it, make them veto, and if they veto, well, let's bring it back. You keep pushing it, and it, unfortunately today everyone is worried about the veto, so therefore it's an excuse for the inaction. But I think it's possible to overcome these things. You know, one of the things that, you know, whether it was Rwanda, whether it was Kosovo, whether it was Sudan, whether it was any of these other places. You know, when I was in government, we were always worried about the Chinese vetoing. But we just kept pushing it and said, look, do it. And ultimately, if you call their bluff, they will ultimately most likely abstain. Or you develop an action such as Kosovo, which, you know, people will question the legality, where you bypass the Security Council and NATO decided to take action on Kosovo. Regional action is a possibility. We don't need to always go through the Security Council. So when we're thinking about whether it's Africa, whether it's about the Middle East, well, let's build regional coalitions. Let's give them the support they need and make it happen. They have the legal right to take action. And let's use our diplomacy, our intelligence, our military to empower those regional actions. And in fact, if you think about it, probably one of the best ways to deal with these issues is a tiering where we try to hit it at the local level to stop it. If you can't, you plus up to the regional level. And then if you can't, then you go to the international level. The problem is if we jump straight up to the international level, you have people in between who abdicate their responsibility. You know, they feel like we don't have to do anything. And then if you fail at the top, you're left with little recourse. So we need to really become more strategic about our approach on all these issues, whether it's peace enforcement, peacekeeping, or accountability.
Hey, my name's Dave. Yesterday, I ate at Burger King, and it was great. And thank you for being here. I appreciate it. So my question is a little bit more of a personal one. So answer it as specifically or as abstractly as you would feel comfortable. But in this day and age, it's, I think, increasingly easy to become overwhelmed and completely crushed down by the weight of everything, and being in contact and knowing about everything that's going on around the world. And in your line of work, I'm sure it can be very easy to become overwhelmed and crushed down by this type of thing. So do you find it that you are able to interact with these type of heavy things in a way that is both real and that you are able to interact in the darkness without being crushed by it and try to do what you can in a world without taking the burden of that upon your back and thus becoming unhealthy or immobilized in such a way? And if so, how do you do that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And dealing, there is a weight to deal with these issues, whether it was when I was with the tribunal or as ambassador. And there, with that weight comes an incredible amount of frustration because the success rate is very, very low. But what gives you the power and the ability to find that strength to you know, protect your soul, if you will, is one, when you look into the eyes of some of these affected people that have lost everything, and we ate at Burger King yesterday, you know, so they know, then you know, you're like, you know what, I owe something, you know, I owe something to humanity, so let me dig in a little bit and push harder and overcome, you know, my personal emotions is nothing compared to what the reality is. Secondly, is when you do have that success, it gives you the power to hit your head up against that wall again for the other 20 times. Because that success is monumental for what it will do to, you know, for countless of people. Now, we, you know, or whomever, you may not hear about it, but you will know that by toughing it out for those 20 or 30 failures and getting that one success, you just helped tens of thousands of people. And knowing that gives you the ability to charge ahead for that next round of fight.
So I think that's about all the time we have for questions, but if you could all please join me in thanking the ambassador for a wonderful forum.
Yep. And, you know, the seats are limited, so go see this film. I'm telling you that you will not be disappointed if you just go online and Google and see the reviews that we've been getting from LA Times, New York Times, and other. They're describing it as a must-see. So go work through Hinckley, through Courtney Macbeth, to register, and you'll really appreciate what you see. Thank you.
We're wrapping up this talk here. If you'd like to hear this entire talk by Ambassador Pierre Richard Prosper, recorded earlier this week, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour podcast. There you can also find a link to the documentary, The Uncondemned, screening next week, November 18th through the 24th, at the Broadway Theater in Salt Lake City. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.